Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. Hope you're having a fun Friday. We're going to have a little bit of fun this hour. A popular new – I'm quite sure it's popular. New feature that we've been doing. This is actually our second time doing it, Offbeat Questions with Jimmy Akin. That is, we get all kinds of questions here at Catholic Answers, and some of them are on beat, and some of them are – a little bit offbeat.
Just want to avoid downbeat questions.
Yeah, I don't think we have any downbeat questions. They are all upbeat, offbeat questions.
Are you familiar with these musical terms?
Yes,
that's where these all come from. Is music.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, well, first of all, I should introduce you. This is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers.
I already know you. We've been introduced.
There are other people listening. I did not know if they told you that in the booth, but other people are listening. All right. So give me
– that. Wait, radio downbeat involves other people listening outside of the studio?
We should have gotten him a radio. I knew we should have done that. We should have gotten him something to – okay. So
that
offbeat
changes things.
I think I know what offbeat is.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So let's say you have a 4-4 beat. One,
right.
1, 2, 3, 4. Some offbeat would mean you're missing one of those beats.
Yeah, now, which can be deliberate. Right. Like, for example, in jazz where you may have extra inserted notes that are off the main beat,
right,
as a way of creating interesting rhythms and melodies.
Right. Okay. So – upbeat. Upbeat, what does that mean actually? I don't know where.
So upbeat and downbeat are they have different meanings. They've come to mean metaphorically happy things are upbeat,
yeah,
sad or depressing things are downbeat. But that's not what it means in music. In music, the downbeat is the – in 2-2 time, it's – so 2-2 time is frequently – for example – is frequently characterized as having a boom chuck, boom chuck, boom chuck.
Yeah.
And the downbeat is the chuck.
Oh.
And it's important to it's a forceful beat that you can put your foot down on when you're dancing.
So it doesn't exactly match up. It's just – I think we made downbeat
because
the association
of down and up.
Yeah.
Are embedded in human psychology,
right,
as metaphors for better, yeah, and worse. And I was talking about this in a recent live stream I did on YouTube and Facebook about the ascension, because it's hooked into this aspect of human psychology. We're vertically oriented creatures. We walk upright.
Yeah.
And we have our eyes. We're very visual. We have our eyes at the top of our bodies. We have our hands, which we interact with things with, near the top of our bodies. And so we're top oriented.
Oh, the good stuff is up. Yeah.
Right. As opposed to, say, quadrupeds like dogs, where they're front oriented.
Oh, yeah.
And so because we're top oriented creatures, we associate up with goodness and superiority. In fact, that's where the word superior comes from. It's from a Latin root, super, it means above.
Uh-huh.
And so we conceive of the upper things as the better things. And that's why we associate – why we imagine God being in heaven even though he's omnipresent.
Right.
And that's why Jesus chose to ascend –
so, yeah,
as a way of showing us he's going to be with God.
Yeah.
And so
it's that kind of a grace builds on nature kind of thing.
Exactly.
Our nature, yeah, assumes that up is good.
Right.
And so in his grace-filled moment, mm-hmm, uses that as,
yeah,
part of making us understand it. We would call this weird questions, I think, but that has a derogatory implication. So offbeat.
Maybe.
Is
a,
yeah. You, really?
Because
some of them are weird.
Some of the, yeah. Well.
Shall we?
Let's.
All right. Let's start with Roy – or no, Ray, excuse me. Ray, and he asks, some ancient paintings show spacemen and UFOs in them. Your opinion?
Yeah. So now what he's talking about here, and when we got these questions, I think there's a little more context. He's talking about like medieval art paintings.
Oh.
And if you look in – and this is something, if you watch UFO documentaries or read UFO books, you'll find them showing sometimes little detail blow-ups of parts of medieval paintings of various scenes that have interesting things in the sky. And sometimes you'll see, like, they have these projections that, I mean, look kind of like flames or maybe like antennas. And there's a famous one that's actually in Yugoslavia in a monastery, if I recall correctly. It's a painting of the crucifixion. And on either side of the cross up in the sky, there are what look like little capsules, which have a person in them. And then they have these projections that, you know, maybe they're flames, maybe they're antenna, and they look like little space capsules. And so people will say, aha, these are like little spaceships. And so they must have seen these UFOs, and it provides evidence for the extraterrestrial UFO hypothesis. And you'll see other similar things in other medieval paintings. And the thing is, it looks that way to us because of our cultural background. But that's not really what's going on in these paintings. And art historians know all about this because these paintings didn't come out of nowhere. They're part of a broad artistic tradition that developed over the centuries, and these are stock images that appear regularly in these paintings, and we know what they mean. In some cases, the figures that you'll see that have like maybe a face with these projections from it are angels. And the projections are the radiance of the angel's holiness.
Oh, I see.
In other cases, like this famous one that has what looks like little space capsules, actually they are the sun and the moon. And they're part of the of a tradition in medieval and Renaissance art of depicting the sun and the moon as witnesses to Jesus's crucifixion. So it's like nature is testifying to Jesus. But just like people today will draw faces on the sun, or you've got the man in the moon, and they'll have rays coming out of the sun and the moon, little projections to symbolize the light coming from them.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's happened here. It's just this is on a style, a particularly stylized end of the spectrum, but you see the sun and the moon in these positions across a wide swath of paintings. And if you want documentation about all this, there's an Italian art historian named Diego Cuoghi, and I'll spell that so you can look him up. But he's done a bunch of work on the web documenting this these artistic traditions and showing you that, no, in fact, these are not UFOs. So if you want to look that up online, just Google Diego, D-I-E-G-O, Cuoghi, C-U-O-G-H-I. And UFOs, and it'll come right up, and you can look at his page. He's got all of the. There's an English version of his page. You can look at, you know, his own screenshots of these paintings and how they relate to each other and so forth.
That's very cool. It's interesting how we read back what has kind of developed in our consciousness.
Yeah,
of this the 1950s flying saucer image.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I see that in a painting from. Yugoslavian, what'd you say? It was a monastery?
Yeah.
All right. So I think we got a we have time for another one before we go. Jeff asks the following question. And these all came from the internet, assuming these questions.
Yeah, these are all Facebook.
Oh, all Facebook questions. All right. Jeff asks, could a priest or the Pope bless an entire ocean at once and make it holy water?
Well, so blessings are – we want to understand what they are. They're not sacraments. They're sacramentals. Okay. And that means they're instituted by the church. They're not of divine institution, and they don't imbue things with sanctifying grace. When the church blesses something, it involves asking God – when the church blesses an object in particular, it involves asking God to help us in the use of this for some purpose. Like if we are saying a blessing over food, we're asking God to help us be nourished by this food and, you know, not to be harmed by it in some ways. And so, you know, there that can cover a variety of things, but the essence is we're asking God to do something to help us with respect to this object. Now, also, blessings are subject to because they're an institution of the church, they're under the church's authority. in a way that the sacraments are not, because the sacraments are given to us by God. And so what happens in a blessing is subject to the church's authority. And so the church can, for example, authorize some people to perform a blessing in its name, but not others. And so there are some blessings only a priest can do. There are some blessings that lay people can do. There are some that only a bishop can do. And so it kind of the way the blessing works is determined by the parameters that the church has set for the blessing and how the church understands it. Well, when you look at the blessing for holy water outside Mass, it doesn't mention anything about blessing an entire ocean. This is kind of a please don't eat the daisies situation. That's a reference to an old book that was by a humor columnist who had was throwing a dinner party, and she gave her children lots of rules about what they must not do at the dinner party to keep from messing it up. Mm-hmm. And she neglected to tell them, please don't eat the daisies. That's what they did. And so this is a situation that the legislator really didn't envision. Having said that, any reasonable person looking at the legislator's intent mm-hmm. would say that when the Pope authorized the blessing for holy water outside of Mass, he did not intend it to be applied to entire oceans.
I see.
So I would say that a priest is not authorized to do that. But that leaves us with the case of the Pope, because it's the Pope who sets the parameters. And so hypothetically speaking, I would say the Pope could bless an entire ocean. Now, he probably wouldn't want to. It'd probably be a bad idea, because it would be a cause of mockery if around the world of, hey, guess what? The Pope, in his recent visit to Hawaii made the entire Pacific Ocean holy water.
Right.
Is that really going to lead people to God? But since we're doing a kind of off-the-wall question show, I would say hypothetically the Pope could do that. And I brought in the Book of Blessings. And I have here, because people will want to know, well, exactly what does this blessing entail? There are different versions of the blessing, but here's the one from the most recent Book of Blessings. When the actual water is blessed, this is what the priest says. Blessed are you, Lord, all-powerful God, who in Christ, the living water of salvation, blessed us and transformed us. Grant that – so here's where the rubber hits the road. Grant that – when we are sprinkled with this water or make use of it, we will be refreshed inwardly by the power of the Holy Spirit and continue to walk in the new life we receive at baptism. So that's what's being asked in the blessing of water outside of Mass. And hypothetically, if a pope chose to, I would say he could turn an entire ocean into holy water for those purposes.
Yeah.
So that when we sprinkle ourselves with us or make use of it, we're reminded of these things, and God mm-hmm. will give us some of his grace and help us walk in the Christian life.
Thanks, Jimmy. It's Offbeat Questions today here at Catholic Answers Live. Offbeat, unusual, off-the-wall questions we don't normally get a chance to get to, but often produce fascinating answers like, could a priest or the Pope bless the ocean? More of those with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Hi, this is Cy Kellett. It's easier than you may think to have a Catholic Answers speaker at your conference or parish event. We've got the speakers fired up, and knowledgeable Catholic Answers speakers have their bags packed and are ready to come see you. Go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com to find out just how easy it is to have a Catholic Answers speaker at your next event. That's CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. Carlo, get your feet off my suitcase.
Tim Staples here. Since May is the month of Mary and Mother's Day, I'm offering a great opportunity for you to help yourself, your family, and your friends to get to know our Blessed Mother more deeply than ever before. And to help make that happen, we're offering my book, Behold Your Mother, a biblical and historical defense of the Marian doctrines, for only $9.95. Folks, that's over 45% off the regular price. From her Immaculate Conception to the Annunciation, from her title as Mother of God to to her perpetual virginity, from her assumption into heaven to her role as co-redemptrix. I'll give you all the facts and back them up with solid biblical evidence in a way that's easy to read, remember, and understand. Make this May the month you, your friends, and your family grow closer to the mother of the church, our Mother Mary. To get your copies of Behold Your Mother, call 1-888-291-8000 or log on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Hillett, your host. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest. Jimmy is the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, among many other things. And we have fun with Jimmy because he lets us ask him weird questions. He doesn't
try to give him straight answers.
Yeah, straight answers to weird questions. Hey, there's a title to this show,
sure,
as well. We titled the show Offbeat Questions. We get all kinds of questions at Catholic Answers, and so we thought we'd share some of the most unusual with you and see what kind of answers Jimmy can come up with. Rainier on Facebook asks, as a Catholic working on the algorithm on a self-driving car, how would you solve a trolley problem? Kill one person or five? What if you program for the former and the one person ended up being an escaped convict and the five are nuns? How do you morally solve this trolley problem?
Okay, so for people who may not be – now, I know, Cy, you're familiar with the trolley problem.
Yes.
But not everybody is, so I'll explain briefly what it is. The trolley problem is a thought experiment that was first proposed by the philosopher Philippa Foot back in the 1960s. And in it, and there are a bunch of versions of it that are designed to help us tease out our ethical intuitions and what principles they contain about what to do in various situations. The original version of the trolley problem goes something like this. Suppose you're on a trolley coming down the street and it's out of control. It's and on the track in front of you are five people that you will run over if nothing changes.
Okay.
But you have the option on the trolley of pulling a lever that will divert the trolley onto a sidetrack. But on that sidetrack is a single person, just one person. And so do you pull the lever or not? If you don't pull the lever, five people are going to die. But if you do pull the lever, you've taken a positive action that will lead to the death of one person versus merely passively allowing something to happen the other way. And so there's a bit of a struggle there.
Yeah.
And most people, when confronted with this version of the trolley problem, say the thing to do is pull the lever. And accepting the consequence of the one person's death is morally legitimate because it's neither a goal nor a means to achieving a goal. It's just a side effect. So the law of double effect applies.
Yeah.
They may not be able to articulate all that, but most people have that intuition.
Right.
So the thing to do in that situation, according to most people, would be to save the five and allow one person to die. But then there are other variations. Like suppose someone just snaps their fingers and you're on the trolley, Cy Kellett, and the other track is Jimmy Akin, who's standing right there, single person with his one of the heels of his cowboy boots trapped in the track, And he's the
Again,
one you're going to have to kill.
Come on, Aiken. You need to be more careful crossing the railroad tracks.
So obviously that changes our feelings when we know one of the persons.
Right.
But still, most people would say you want to save the five person's life. Just because you're friends with someone, I mean, that may shape your relations with them somewhat, but it's not enough to let five people die.
Right.
Then there are other situations where it gets more complex. Like suppose you're not on the trolley. Suppose you're on an overpass and the trolley is going to go on a track under the overpass and kill five people. And you don't have a lever, but what you do have is a really overweight person standing next to you that you could throw onto the track so that that person ends up dying,
right.
But it stops the trolley from killing the other five. Well, from one perspective, it looks like you're still killing one person to save five. But at this point, most people's ethical intuitions flip and say you cannot kill the one person. You cannot throw the overweight person over the railing to stop the trolley.
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a morally different proposition.
Right. And then the philosopher wants to say, okay, why is it morally different?
Right.
What changes it? And because you could say, you know, the law of double effect still applies here.
Yeah,
if you throw the person over and they survive, that's great. You saved everybody.
Yeah.
You don't know for a fact they're going to die if they don't. So their death is not a means or an end. It's a side effect. But seems to be involved here is we're programmed to not manhandle people in this way.
Yeah.
We're directly involving ourselves in somebody's death in a greater way than just pulling a lever and having machines do something.
Yeah.
And so that seems to be one of the factors that's relevant here. Now, and to answer this question, and it's a very relevant one because right now we're on the verge of self-driving cars. They already exist and it's a question now of programming them so that
– And they have already killed people as a matter of fact.
They have, or at least in – you know, accidentally.
Accidentally, yeah.
And the key now is how can we make them so that they're safer than human drivers, which I think is an achievable goal. I think that'll eventually happen. But I would say in this case, I would, as the programmer, say save the five people rather than the one. And I would say if it turns out that in the second one where he says, if I chose not to do that, which is actually not the choice I would make, but if for, let's say, legal reasons, I had to program the car in such a way that it would go after the five people instead of diverting to where the one is.
Yeah.
And if it turned out that those five people were nuns and the one was an escaped convict, I would say that's unfortunate, but still we don't make life or death decisions in this kind of circumstance based on the moral character of the person.
Right. Yeah.
And so it would be unfortunate, and that may be a factor that may play in some of our decisions in life, but ultimately we want to treat lives as fundamentally equal. And so we don't want to say, well, this person is more pious or righteous or whatever, and therefore they get to live.
Yeah, that puts us in a – then we're playing God.
In fact, people in that situation would – the holier people would likely say, no, save the soul that needs more time to repent.
Right. The nuns may well be ready.
Yeah.
Let's see. I just got to check my clock here real quick. I'm going to give you the question. We'll start on an answer. Maybe you won't – maybe we can finish it. Maybe we'll have to continue on the other side. Margot on Facebook asks, did Mary or Jesus ever get sick?
Ah, this is an easy one. We don't know. The scriptures never tell us. What we can say is that they were both living on earth in an unglorified state where they could suffer injury such as Jesus getting hungry, which we know happened. Hunger is a form of pain. Jesus being brutalized and killed.
And
so he was clearly subject to mortal physical attacks. Well, essentially, sicknesses are, at least based on the germ theory of disease, those sicknesses are caused by by attacks by small organisms, mm-hmm. either viruses or microbes. And since they were living in an unglorified state, they were in principle open to attacks by humans and by bears and by microbes. Mm-hmm. Now, they may not have ever fallen victim to those because God could miraculously preserve them, and we know he did miracles in their lives. But unless that happened, they would have been subject to attacks by microorganisms the same way they were vulnerable to attacks by macroorganisms.
Mm-hmm. Margo, thanks very much for that question. If I may, does that same answer apply to Adam and Eve?
It would in principle as well, yes.
Like they before also, the fall, I mean.
Well, yeah, they were living in, according to the standard theological account, they were living in a state of elevated nature, but not the full glorified state. Otherwise, they never would have fallen.
Right. Okay. So they're not in their right. They're not in glory.
So it's potentially, but we know less about that than we do about the circumstances in which Jesus and Mary lived.
What if they had never fallen? Would they have ever made it into glory with God?
We don't know. Standard understanding that they had a probationary period, and if they passed it, they would have received
just gone right to
graces.
God. Yeah. I hear the music, so we have to take a break. We're covering offbeat, strange, off-the-wall, weird questions today. We get so many questions here at Catholic Answers. I'm taking the weird ones today for a little bit of fun on Friday with Jimmy Akin. More of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. We all hear sayings like these, and we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers. Nobody can seem to place their origin, but by sheer repetition, they've acquired a halo of truth. In my new book, What the Saints Never Said, I look at over 40 of these well-known sayings and track them back to their original sources. You'll be surprised at what I found. Some are close to what was really said. Many were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few of these sayings were simply made up. I hope by setting the record straight, I can make you aware of the theological errors that can lead us away from the faith and offer you authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to our faith. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We live in an age of indifference. Does truth exist? Maybe. Is there a God? Who knows? Does it matter what religion you believe in? Probably not. If you think so, fine. I'm spiritual, but not religious. Apologist Matt Nelson says this indifference is the great spiritual sickness of our age, a product of the relativism that dominates our culture. And rather than remain indifferent, he did something about it. In his new book, Just Whatever, Matt looks at the different kinds of indifference you likely encounter in your friends and family members, and maybe in yourself, and offers an antidote to the problem that plagues our age. Order your copy of Just Whatever today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is on EWTN television.
Catholic Answers Live is one of the longest running and most listened to Catholic radio programs of all time, and now it's also a TV show. I think you'll really get a different take from the TV show. The Bible quote or catechism paragraph the speaker is explaining can be put up on the screen, along with helpful graphics and other related material that really bring the topic to life.
Catholic Answers Live, TV, Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It is a Friday. Hope your Friday is going very, very well. We have the great pleasure of having Jimmy Akin here with us for a little bit of a fun topic. We get into some serious stuff. I mean, we got into the law of double effect or mm-hmm. last question.
It's a little downbeat.
But that was a little downbeat. Let's pick it up here. Mm-hmm. But we have a lot of fun because we get to ask weird questions when we do this show with Jimmy. And these questions come to us via Facebook. And they are among the strangest questions we have gotten. And they're a lot of fun to answer. And Jonathan on Facebook, Jimmy, asks, if we were to colonize another planet in the future, how would the Catholic Church on Earth communicate with the representatives, bishop, church, with presiding residing priest, lay congregation on the other planet. In other words, what would have to be done or prepared before sending such representatives as part of a colonization?
Okay. You know, it's like no one has ever even thought about this.
I am very pleased only, that this question is here.
If only there was a book. And, you know, maybe it would be called – maybe it would be about how a bishop from Mars comes back to Earth for his ad limina visit.
Yeah.
And it could even be – it could be called ad limina.
Yeah.
And it could be written by someone named Cyril Kellett and be available on Amazon right now for download.
That's so funny that Jonathan asked that question because I did write a science fiction novel about this very question.
Mm-hmm.
And – but, you know,
so maybe
I think,
you should answer this.
Well, I'll try – I'll say just this. I think many Catholics don't know – there's certain things that not everybody knows, and one of them is that ordinary bishops, that is the bishop of a diocese, essentially, ordinary bishops have to go to Rome every 5 years.
Approximately.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
And
it's not always really five.
And ad limina means to the thresholds.
Mm-hmm.
And
to the limits or thresholds.
And you're supposed to visit the
tombs of Peter and Paul.
Tombs of Peter and Paul, but you also visit
the Pope and other people in the Roman Curia.
Right, yeah. So that was the idea for my book was that in the future, people live on Mars,
mm-hmm.
and this bishop who was born on Mars has to go to Rome for his mm-hmm. first ad limina visit.
Mm-hmm.
And now the thing is, I think Jonathan might be talking about interstellar type things because it's very easy to communicate with Mars. It takes a few minutes. There's a delay.
About 20 minutes,
but,
yeah.
But so, yeah. So go ahead. You can. Take
oh, okay.
From there.
So, in terms of communication with them, so there are sort of two parts to his question. One is communication. One that your novel deals with is transportation. If there's a way to, within a reasonable period of time, get back to Earth, then presumably you would have a situation like that where the bishops from another planet would be required to come back to Earth for consultations, either for ad limina visits or other forms of consultation, just like bishops go to Rome now.
Right.
That didn't used to happen when we didn't have airplanes and it was sea voyages to get anywhere and it could take weeks or months to get somewhere.
Yeah.
So this is actually a situation we faced somewhat before. And in some ages, we didn't even have the ability to do ship transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been periods where bishops were cut off from contact with Rome for extended periods, especially in the age of exploration. And this is what we're talking about here, space exploration.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be situations where space travel would enable them to get back in a reasonable way in terms of time and expense, in which case they'd do that. If they can't get back for face-to-face communications, then obviously there would be a utilization of whatever means of communication are available. That could include things like light speed limited communications like message lasers you could use to communicate with Mars and stuff or radio waves. There could be communication via RAM robot where you like have a robotic spaceship that takes a package of messages from Earth somewhere.
Yeah.
Then depending on how the laws of physics shake out, there could be hypothetically faster than light communications through something like a device from science fiction called an Ansible, which would allow instantaneous or near instantaneous communication faster than light over interstellar distances. That's, of course, purely speculative at this point. We don't have a way to make an Ansible. If such communication were going to be difficult and improbable – and irregular, then that kind of gets us to the second part of the question, what would happen before people go? Now, in the history of colonization, people do tend to take their religious figures with them when they establish a colony,
mm-hmm.
but they often don't on earlier exploratory missions. So just like Catholic astronauts who went to the moon didn't take a priest with them.
Mm-hmm.
There could be early astronauts or early colonists who didn't have priests, but eventually the church would want to care for their spiritual needs and would want to get a bishop in particular in whatever extraterrestrial colonies we had. And so there would be a need for a volunteer, and there would be no shortage of volunteers for that. Part of the missionary spirit you know, will see to the fact that there would be volunteers. But then there would be a really rigorous screening and training process that would happen, because that bishop and the priests he would ordain, and the future bishops that would be consecrated, if there was not regular travel between Earth and this other place, there'd be a risk there. You could you want to do everything you can to ensure continuity of ecclesiastical communion so that you don't have a schism or a heresy develop in the colony. And so there would be a lot of screening and a lot of training, and then there would also probably be some juridical safeguards put in place as well, so that if, let's say, the bishop's advisors on this colony world determined that he's veering into heresy, that he could then be deposed and a new bishop consecrated. And you'd need some additional, you'd actually need more than one bishop to ensure continuity in that process. But there could potentially be some juridical things you could do to ensure ecclesiastical communion continues.
Jonathan, thanks very much for that question. I had that question myself several years ago, and a novel came out of it, or a novella. Nick, you're going to have to help me with the clock. How much time are we looking at? Okay, so we have time for another question. Anthony asks, here we go. If general AI is created, AI meaning artificial intelligence, does it falsify the Catholic teaching about the soul's necessity for intelligence? How likely is its creation, in your opinion, Jimmy?
I don't know that the church has a teaching that the soul is necessary for intelligence. That's going to depend on how you define intelligence. I think so the soul is understood to be the life force, the animating principle of a life form. So even unintelligent animals have souls. According to the historically most popular theological opinion, they don't survive death. If it's and you need to have a rational soul in order to survive death. But all living things have a soul. That's what keeps them from being alive rather than dead. In terms of intelligence, intelligence can be understood in different ways. We need to distinguish here between information processing ability, which is one of the things we think of as intelligence is involving. Someone's intelligent if they have a lot of information and can process a lot of information, then they're intelligent. And intelligence in that sense, I don't think you need to even be alive for, because computers right now can have and manipulate information. And so I don't have a theoretical problem imagining that one day you can have computer algorithms that so closely mimic the a human level of information processing that they could, for example, pass what's known as the Turing test. It was a test proposed by the mathematician and computer scientist Alan Turing in England, who said, you know, what would happen if you had a computer that was so sophisticated that if you're typing to it, you can't tell it's not a human.
Yeah.
And that's what's known as the Turing test. If an artificial intelligence can fool you into thinking it's a human after an extended conversation, or you can't tell the difference between it and a human, then it passes the Turing test. So I don't have a problem saying that, well, that kind of information processing could one day be done on machines. I don't know how close that is. I'm not a computer scientist, so I'm really not qualified to have an opinion there. I tend to be skeptical of both extremes on that question. Some computer scientists are like, oh yeah, we're going to have AI, robust AI in 20 years. Well, they've been saying that for 40 years.
Yeah.
And it's proved really hard. Others have said, oh, this is fundamentally impossible. It'll never happen. I'm skeptical of nevers too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's imminent, but I don't rule it out that this could happen either. So if it did happen, I would say, well, it doesn't have a soul and it doesn't have consciousness, which is something that biological life forms seem to have based on our own experience. We know we're conscious and other people, other humans are conscious, and it sure seems like animals are conscious.
Yeah.
But computers don't seem to have the apparatus they need physically to be conscious. Mm-hmm. Right now they're based on silicon chips. They could they'll eventually be based on something else if quantum computing works out. But fundamentally, I don't see a way for machines to be conscious. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that the soul may be more directly connected with than just information processing ability. So, I would say that the soul has various faculties, and the human soul has robust information processing is one of them. But I think that's a separable faculty you could duplicate with a machine, and it wouldn't have a soul.
The creepy thing, though, to me, is that you could make it seems not difficult, given what could happen over the next 20, 30, 100 years, that you could make a robot or whatever that mimics human beings very, very well so that you could not distinguish between the robot and the thing. And then people are – that's been very confusing to us.
Mm-hmm. And potentially very dangerous, because one of the things that happens when you do have artificial intelligence achieve a certain skill level is it then exceeds dramatically – what humans can do, because it has faster information processing.
Oh, yeah.
So I've seen like videos of where they have hooked up a learning – primitive AI, but it's like it's got a learning algorithm that learns how to play a game, and you'll watch it playing Pong or something or a Tetris-like game or something, and it'll take it a few hours and it's experimenting randomly and figuring out how to play this game, and then it hits a tipping point where it suddenly knows how to play the game and wins infallibly every time.
Yeah.
And it's not intelligent. I mean, it's not conscious, but it's got this skill down.
Yeah.
And so can you imagine right now they have those phone salespeople that try to trick you into thinking they're a human being when really it's a recording.
Yeah.
And they're starting to even become interactive a little bit.
They are, yeah.
And can you imagine if you have a robust AI with a sales algorithm that it's now.
And they're really good at it.
Or a con algorithm.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There are some real dangers there that we're going to have to think about as this technology matures.
Yeah, plus they'll probably learn kung fu. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more weird, strange, odd questions on this Friday with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Tim Staples here. Since May is the month of Mary and Mother's Day, I'm offering a great opportunity for you to help yourself, your family, and your friends to get to know our Blessed Mother more deeply than ever before. And to help make that happen, we're offering my book, Behold Your Mother, a biblical and historical defense of the Marian doctrines for only $9.95. Folks, that's over 45% off the regular price. From her Immaculate Conception to the Annunciation, from her title as Mother of God to her perpetual virginity, from her assumption into heaven to her role as co-redemptrix, I'll give you all the facts and back them up with solid biblical evidence in a way that's easy to read, remember, and understand. Make this May the month you, your friends, and your family grow closer to the Mother of the Church, our Mother Mary. To get your copies of Behold Your Mother, call 1-888-291-8000 or log on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Are faith and science compatible? Join us this September 27th to the 30th as we tackle the topic of Catholic Answers' 5th National Apologetics Conference, Faith and Science, a lively and inspiring event designed to jumpstart your faith. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Do you enjoy tedious lectures full of facts you'll never use? We didn't think so. That's why we're launching the Council of Trent, Trent Horn's engaging new podcast. Every week, you'll get lively lessons in Catholic teaching, as well as a new conversation roadmap that will help you share your Catholic faith with anyone, anytime, anywhere. Visit TrentHornPodcast.com now to find out how you can subscribe to this exciting new podcast.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So happy to have you with us on this Friday as we take weird questions, strange questions, out of the ordinary questions. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy?
Yeah, I realized I said something backwards earlier in the show about downbeats.
Okay.
And the downbeat is the accentuated beat, and it's usually on the first.
Oh, okay.
Of a measure. So like in a boom chuck, it's the boom.
I gotcha. Okay. And what's the other one called? The upbeat or the...
There can be more than one
beat,
depending on the time signature you're using.
Well, thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah.
Because I'd have left here with a completely wrong impression about downbeat.
I like to correct things when I can.
Yeah, I know. Okay. So here's a question that Lauren asks on Facebook. And I'm interested in this because it's a question about lying, but it's also a question about somebody I've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren asks, is it moral or in any way permissible to lie to a Cyberman?
Okay. Actually, I was surprised because this came from more than one person.
Really?
Yeah. So I guess maybe some people out there have been discussing lying to Cybermen. Cybermen are a transhumanist race of people on the television show Doctor Who.
Oh,
and
okay.
So they're like humans that have been augmented by mechanical means, and that's why they're called Cybermen, because they have cybernetic devices embedded in them. In fact, if you look at them from the outside, they can even appear to just be robots, but there's really a person in there, or parts of a person are in there.
Right.
Now, the Cybermen generally on Doctor Who are antagonists. So they have this ideology where they want to upgrade everybody, and they have a specific emotion inhibitor that prevents the – because if you upgrade somebody against their will, you're traumatizing them.
Yeah.
You know? And so they have like an emotion inhibitor to prevent the person who's been upgraded from experiencing horror at what's happened to them. And then they have this set of ideological directives that are implanted in them to go out and cyberize everybody. And so that's the general nature of Cybermen. I can't help wondering, because I do a Doctor Who podcast with a couple of other gentlemen, Father Corey Stika and Don Bettinelli. We have a show called Secrets of Doctor Who, which you can find at sqpn.com. And I know we've been talking about Cybermen recently, and I can't help thinking maybe we discussed lying, but in connection with Cybermen.
And that's why everyone's asking.
This is an echo of that, but I don't remember us discussing lying. So here's the answer I would give in the abstract. It's going to depend on your theory of lying. Some understandings of lying would say you can never do it under any circumstances. And then there will be theories where that gets qualified in various ways. Some people have proposed you can feed false information to someone who is not an actual moral agent, which Cybermen are not because of their programming. They don't have free will.
Oh.
I don't tend to favor that one, but I personally, and this is just my own personal view, it's not church teaching, I tend to favor the ethical traditions that say that lying in tactical circumstances, such as in wartime, can be legitimate. So you can do things like feints and things like that to make an enemy think you're going to attack at one point when really you're going to attack somewhere else. And those just seem essential to the conduct of war, which is legitimate in principle as a means of legitimate defense. And so and similarly, I think it's okay to lie to Nazis about whether you have Jews in your attic. And I have a theory about that goes into that. I think essentially when you lie to someone, you're damaging their belief system the same way if you punch someone, you're damaging their body.
Okay.
And just as – and so I view lying as a form of damage. But there are situations in which it's legitimate to damage somebody either physically or mentally as a form of defense. And so since Cybermen are aggressors, you could deceive them legitimately the same way you could punch them legitimately, or in their case, expose them to gold dust because it clogs their vents.
Whoosh, there's an out.
Yeah. So my personal view would be yes, but it's going to depend on your theory of lying, and not all theories of lying countenance that.
Okay, fair enough. Now I know what a Cyberman is as well. Let's see if we can get Kelly's question in before we have to go for the day. Is the multiverse theory one that postulates that every possible thing can happen, does happen, but in a different universe? I think I got that right. Mm-hmm. Those are her words. Compatible with at all with Christianity?
So there are different theories of how there might be multiple universes. Some of them would only postulate a small number of alternative universes. Some would postulate a very large but finite number of other universes. And then there are versions that would postulate an infinite number of universes. But the thing is, there's more than one kind of infinity. And so even if you say there are infinite universes, that doesn't guarantee that every possible thing happens in them. Having said that, the creative power of God is infinite, and God is the absolute form of infinity. Mm-hmm. So God is capable by his omnipotence of creating every possible logical state of affairs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a potential qualifier that I really don't have time to go into.
Okay.
But God is capable of actualizing via his omnipotence every physically possible, logically possible state of affairs. And therefore, he could create an infinite number of universes in which all these different permutations play out. And that's not inconsistent with the Catholic faith. It's within the power of God to actualize that. The only kink, which is the one we really can't explore in any depth, is free will. In these situations, if he chooses to include free will in a universe, then he's limiting the particular states that are actualized and making them contingent on the free will decisions of creatures in that universe. But still, he could create multiple, an infinite number of universes with free will that, even though you can't guarantee they'll produce every possible free will outcome, you could have a potential moral certitude that virtually every free will outcome will actualize at some point.
I'm not quite sure how this works, but mm-hmm. does that kind of multiverse theory give us the idea that there's another person like me there?
Even if there are just a very large but finite number of universes, eventually it can be quite plausible that there would be someone who would be very, very similar to you or even identical to you.
Uh-huh. That's so freaky. But it is presented.
But it's not you.
But no, it's not me, right. But it's presented as a physical possibility by modern physics.
Correct.
It's not known, but it's certainly one of the possibilities that's presented.
That's correct.
And you're saying there's not a logical objection to it from the Christian point of view either.
Not from a Christian point of view, no. We don't want to limit God's creative ability. He can do anything logically possible.
That is a very cool question. Thank you very much for that question, Kelly.
And I should say logical possibility means the terms involved don't contradict.
Right.
Like married bachelor,
yeah,
or four-sided triangle. God can make all kinds of bachelors, but none of them are married. God can make all kinds of triangles, but none of them have four sides, because then they wouldn't be triangles.
Right. So God can't make a universe in which there's no God.
Correct.
Because there's God everywhere in all mm-hmm. of them.
Yeah.
And also, would there be an internal thing where, okay, so say God, let's just keep it at two.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in universe two could logically contradict the possibility of universe one. Like you can't mm-hmm. say, I guess the basic one would be that universe two can't exist in as a sole universe. If there's two universes, that's a logical impossibility.
That would be a logical contradiction.
But there probably are internal things that can't happen as well.
Correct, depending on the rules that God sets up. Now, divine logic applies to all universes. Yeah. But in addition to that, he can set up the laws of physics differently in different universes.
When you say divine logic, that means that you can't say that there's no good or evil.
Correct.
In one of these.
Because that's all rooted in God's eternal nature,
yeah.
Which applies everywhere.
I love weird questions on Friday. Thanks for doing this with us,
My
Jimmy.
My pleasure.
We have more questions, I note. I hope we can do another show.
Yeah, we'll save these questions for the next time.
And you can always email us at radio@catholic.com if you have a strange question that maybe you've been reluctant to ask. No, we love them for the weird questions show, strange questions. The actual title is Offbeat Questions with Jimmy Akin. That does it for us. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations, and we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.